Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
Thank you very much, Lindsay, and thank you so much to the Dartmouth Literary Festival. The Oldie is delighted to be associated with it. And in your brilliant introduction, you neglected Andrew's most important job, which is the Oldie Man of Letters columnist at the Oldie. We're having a dispute before your write-up in your catalogue suggested he's written 60 books. I counted them. It looked like just a pathetic 56, I counted this morning. But his range is so huge. In his latest column, coming out in a couple of weeks, it's about the row between John Betjeman and C.S. Lewis, because it's a century since Betjeman went up to Magdalen College, Oxford, to be taught by C.S. Lewis, and had a terrible time. And only after Andrew wrote this column did I realise he's written biographies of both of them.
Is this true?
Andrew, would you say you're addicted to writing, would you say?
Yes. It's a bit like the bit in the Tale of Two Cities, which I think is such a wonderful Dickens novel, which I'm sure you've all read, where Dr. Manette, when he's let out of the Bastille, where he taught himself to be a cobbler and make shoes, he's still, even if he's no longer got the bit of leather and the hammer and the nails in front of him, he's still found going through the motions of making the shoes. And I'm like that with the writing. I would be miserable if I wasn't writing something.
And I must say, as somebody who commissions Andrew once a month for his column, you're an absolute joy to work with, because you're, as well as the column being brilliant, it's always early, and you always say when you send it in, if it's no good, bin it. You're a novelist, a historian, a biographer, and a journalist. In your obituary, what order would you like those words to be?
I hope it's soon, the obituary, but it would only be fitting for an oldie. Yeah. But I doubt whether there'll be an obit, except in some obscure parish magazine or something. But journalist, I think, first of all, hack.
But, great honour, yeah.
Journalism is the most fun of all the types of writing, because it appears immediately. Whereas, you know, if you write a book, you hand it into the publisher, and then you might not hear anything for about 6 months. And then they suddenly ring up and say, well, we suddenly realise we've got to go into print and rush it out. But whereas if I hand in an article to the Oldie, you're always nice and send a message back, ping, by almost faster than you'd have time to read it, saying that you've read it and so on. So it's much more exciting to be a journalist. And I do find, I'm sure you do, all of you, that living in the world at the moment is both frightening and appalling, but also very, very interesting. And so to have the opportunity to write about it in some shape or form, in the Times or the Daily Mail or the Oldie or whatever I happen to be asked to write, is a great privilege.
And early this year, you addressed an important institution, the Rectory Society, and you were interviewed by Charles Moore,
the former
editor of the Spectator and the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph and the biographer of Margaret Thatcher, and he said he'd once seen you writing, and he said it was extraordinary. It was like automatic writing, presumably a piece for the Spectator. And you find writing very easy.
I think it was in the Telegraph when he was the editor.
Right.
And in those days, you still went into the paper, because it was pre-internet, and you didn't have emails or anything like that.
But so you find it very easy. It does come almost
automatic. Well, I do like the actual act of writing, I must say. I feel very... When you mention Mrs. Thatcher, it's not my favourite politician, I must confess. But one of the things I feel really sorry for her about is the fact that she had... When she became old, she had that condition. Medics among you all know what it's called, I've forgotten, but your hands start curling up like this. That's right, and she couldn't hold a pen. That to me would be torture.
And Andrew, we're here to talk first about your most recent book, Goethe, His Faustian Life, The Extraordinary Story of Modern Germany, A Troubled Genius, and the Poem That Made Our World. And I'm sure in Dartmouth, everyone has read the works of Goethe, but I read the book and enjoyed it enormously. It struck me as a plea to read Faust particularly. Is that right?
Yes, I think it is right. And I mean, I've called it his Faustian life. Goethe lived, he was an oldie, he lived to 82, and he only finished this poem, Faust, a few months before he died. He started writing it when he was in his 20s, and it's a retelling, as some of you will know if you've read it, but if not, allow me just for a minute to explain. Germans love the story of Faust, partly because he was a German, of course, the real Faust, if there ever was one, but partly because Christopher Marlowe wrote the tragical history of Dr. Faustus, which was a kind of mythic version of it. And there were lots, by the time Marlowe wrote that play, in the time of Shakespeare, there were lots of Faust books and Faust legends and Faust stories being told in Germany. And English actors went to Germany a lot in those days, and so there were plenty of opportunities for Germans to see plays about Faust. And the classic legend, which everyone in this room knows, is that Faust was this clever man who wanted to know more and more and more, and realized sheer human reason, or what we would call science, they would call philosophy, natural philosophy, wasn't ever going to give you the secrets of the universe. And so magic was the way that he followed in order to try and penetrate the secrets. And in order to achieve high magical status, he sold his soul to the evil one, to the devil. In the Faust of Goethe, it becomes a very different story, because although when he began the story as a young student, he was a law student in Strasbourg when he was writing this thing. He was going to follow the Marlowe story. And there's already been lots of German plays on the subject. Little by little by little, he realised that Faust and the devil are really sort of friends. And they don't ever make this agreement. For one thing, in the play, because Faust is a non-religious believer. He believes in a kind of wishy-washy pantheism, but he doesn't believe it's necessary to be an afterlife, let alone a heaven and hell. So there wouldn't be any point in making the Faustian pact with the devil that we all talk about as a figure of speech. And as the story develops, in Faust Part 1, the new element, again, I'm sure you know this, but the new element that even as a very young man Goethe introduced to the story was that this love interest, Faust falls in love with this innocent young girl called Gretchen, Margaret, and seduces her. And when she becomes pregnant, he abandons her and she kills the baby and she's put to death. Faust escapes, and although the devil at the end of the play is calling out for her soul, there's a mystic voice from heaven saying that she will be redeemed. And then you have Part 2, which he was middle-aged by the time he began to write, which is a completely extraordinary phantasmagoria of ingredients in which Gretchen appears to be more or less forgotten. Faust is moving on a world stage, and the devil has really just become a kind of alter ego of Faust. In the early stages, they are having a dialogue with the emperor of this grand European country, it's not really specified. And it's obviously, although it's meant to be set in Renaissance times, it's obviously really in modern times, i.e. Napoleonic times, how can Europe get to grips with all sorts of things which are beginning to happen? The beginning of modern capitalism, the printing of paper money, the techniques of modern warfare, all these things are poured in. And then there's this very strange scene in Act 3 in which Faust falls in love with Helen of Troy. You probably remember in the Marlowe story, in one of his visions of lust, Faust falls in love with an image of Helen as a as a sex object, really. Whereas in Goethe, who was obsessed by ancient Greece and Hellenic culture, and also by the contemporary War of Independence in Greece, which was happening when he was writing, the union between Faust and Helen is a full union, and they have a baby. And the baby is Lord Byron, basically. He's called Euphorion, but as he falls from the skies after an extraordinary Icarus-like flight, the stage direction says the audience will recognize. Of course, there couldn't possibly be an audience. It's an unstageable, unwieldy drama that you're reading it. The audience will recognize a very well-known person. The modern editor has to add, i.e. Lord Byron. But by the end, it's quite topical, given the distinguished visitors this country has been having in the last week. By the end, this very powerful old man, Faust, has gone into real estate. And the final act of Faust is extraordinarily like the story of the golf courses in Scotland, which a certain gentleman, famous, who will be recognised by everybody, because there's one dogged little couple. Do you remember when Mr. Trump wanted to buy one bit of, I think, I forget if it was Aberdeenshire or Fife, but he wanted to buy one last little property which was stuck in where he wanted to put one of his hideous golf courses. And a brave old man, we all cheered, I think, he refused to sell to Trump, and Trump put every kind of pressure upon him. Well, Faust does that in the end of this play and behaves absolutely appallingly. The man on the golf course in Faust and his nice old wife are actually burnt to death at Faust's decree. So it's a very dark poem. I call it a poem more than a play because, as I say, you couldn't really... There have been a few idiots in Germany who tried to stage Faust Part 2, but you couldn't do it. And when you see films of Faust or whatever they may be, it's always the Part 1, the Margaret drama, the Gretchen drama. But when you've finished reading it and you think, is this the work of a complete loony, which on one level the answer is, it feels like that sometimes, it turns out to be a poem about how the modern world and modern men and women such as ourselves have come to change our view of the world and how we come to be where we are now. And it's both remarkable in the way that he's used this myth, but it's also a kind of prophecy. There are so many things, I don't want to talk about Faust too much because there are other things to talk about, but there are so many things in that poem which were immediately recognised by the contemporaries who read it in the 19th century. And I think one of the sad things about, one of the many, many sad things about history in the last 150 years is the estrangement between the English and the Germans. When Thomas Carlyle, who's slightly been cancelled recently, but is a good writer in my opinion, when he championed Goethe's fame in England, most reading people had read some, at least, of Goethe's work. They'd either read his scientific work. He wrote whole tracts on colour theory and optics, which were translated into English, and, for example, Turner was completely bowled over by them. Or they'd read his plays, or he'd read his novels. I mean, he was extraordinarily broad in his interests. But as I say, most thinking, reading people in England had read Goethe. If you go to Disraeli's house, Hughenden, have you ever been to it? It's National Trust. It's marvellous. It's absolutely fantastic. You must go if you haven't seen it. And one of the most amusing things in it is that, as you know, he had this extraordinarily sort of camp, but on the whole not entirely mocking relationship with the Queen Victoria. And when he had her to lunch, he didn't want her to have to sit in the dining room with her funny little fat sausage legs dangling from the chairs, because they were chairs for a normal-sized person, and as you know, she was tiny. So one of the dining chairs has the legs cut off, so it's like a child's chair, so she could sit down. But when she came to lunch, she brought a copy of Goethe's Faust as her present. And she and Prince Albert knew great chunks of it by heart. And yes, they were German, and yes, they loved German literature, but it was absolutely normal that you could refer to elements or scenes in Faust as you and I might swap scenes in an Agatha Christie novel.
And you can speak German, and you translated the German of Faust beautifully, but you also, you've told me that it's basically untranslatable.
It's very nice to say that it was done well. But
beautiful as the translations are, you really need to speak German to understand quite how brilliant he is. And you've said what a brilliant poet Goethe was.
He was one of those people, Byron was another actually, who could turn his hand to any type of verse form, and who was completely fluent from boyhood onwards, fluent in writing verse. And so he was, and most of his verse is very accessible, and you can understand it. And it is very, very beautiful, and he is one of the great lyric poets of world literature. But Faust is so dense, for the reasons I've been waffling on about, that it is almost impossible to translate. And to that extent, it is worth going to the trouble of learning. It's not that much trouble, but some trouble learning German.
Yeah. And just to sketch out his life, born in 1749, died in 1832.
Yes.
Goethe came from a rich background. His father was a lawyer, is that right?
His father was a rich lawyer. And he grew up in Frankfurt. And when he was ennobled later in life, he said there was no honour that the Holy Roman Emperor could bestow on a citizen of Frankfurt if they were one of the aristocrats of Frankfurt. But he was very far from being an aristocrat. His father came from, although he was a rich lawyer himself, a line of people who had run pubs, and before that were humble shopkeepers. His mother was slightly posher, but they were rich, middle-class people in Frankfurt. And his father wanted Goethe to be a lawyer. He sent him to two universities to study the law. And the fact about Goethe that he always wished to conceal about himself was that he was, in fact, a very good lawyer. And he liked to think of himself as just a person who lolled about writing poetry rather than studying the law. He wrote this novel while he was starting to write Faust. He wrote this novel called The Sorrows of Young Werther. And it's sort of ultra-romantic novel about a young man who falls so hopelessly in love with somebody else, and it's an unhappy love story, that he takes his own life. And that's how the sorrows end. And it became an absolute sensational, famous book. Goethe was always slightly miffed, because he wrote it when he was 24 or something, if in his maturity he met people who said, "Oh, I so adore your work," and he hoped they were going to say, "I love your poems, I love your plays," whatever it might be, and they would always say, "I love the Sorrows of Young Werther." And when Napoleon invaded Germany and asked to meet the great man, he did hope that Napoleon, who was such a Faustian figure, would say, "I love Faust," but instead, of course, Napoleon said, "I love The Sorrows of Young Werther." And if you go to New York and see in the Herman Morgan Library, you can see Napoleon's own copy of The Sorrows of Young Werther, which is absolutely dodgy. And I believe Napoleon when he said, I don't believe everything about Napoleon, but I believe him when he said he'd read it seven times. And so that's really how he, on the strength of that novel, an 18-year-old duke called Karl August of Saxe-Weimar came to see Goethe in Frankfurt and said, "Why don't you come and stay with us in Weimar?" Weimar was an absolute, I don't know if you've seen Weimar, but it's a beautiful city. But when the young duke was there with his wonderful mother, Anna Amalia, she had the idea of starting a kind of cultural centre, rather like Dartmouth, I suppose, in which she called it the Court of the Muses, and all the famous and wonderful composers and philosophers and writers would want to come there. When Goethe first went there, it was really just this big castle where they all lived, very beautiful castle, and a sort of farmyard. There was almost nothing there. It was a tiny village. But little by little by little, thanks to the Duchess Amalia, it grew up. And Goethe stayed with them for a few weeks. He was a tremendous show-off. The flunkies were running the court. The sort of stiff old German aristocrats hated him. And they couldn't wait for him to be sent back to Frankfurt with his tail between his legs. But a kind of bromance grew up between the young duke and Goethe. And he stayed, and he stayed, and he stayed. And what the young duke discovered, and Duchess even more, Amalia, his mother, was that Goethe was actually going to be very good at helping him run this funny little place. They put him in charge of the army, they put him in charge of road building, they put him in charge of reopening the silver mines to revive their economy. And by the end, he was in effect the prime minister of this little duchy. So all the activities that this writer undertook, writing his plays, writing his poems, writing his novels, were done against the background of completely full-time political activity. And that's one of the reasons that he took so long to finish Faust. And it's an extraordinary story, really. If you haven't been to Weimar, do go, because it's really beautiful. His house is of interest. I think you, as an architectural historian, would like the house.
And he was also extraordinary scientist. Wright said that he wrote about evolution before Darwin and even discovered a bone that only exists in the fetus. Is that right?
He was a scientist, and what Harry's just said is completely true. It's really in the generation of Goethe and Erasmus Darwin, the grandfather of Charles Darwin, that the idea of evolution begins. And Goethe has this idea that all complicated life forms that we see, both in plants and in animals, derive, in both cases, from an early, very simple life form. And that is, roughly speaking, what we all believe now, I think, that it was regarded as completely revolutionary when Goethe wrote these two books, The Metamorphosis of Plants and Ditto of Animals. He's more or less the exact contemporary of Erasmus Darwin, and they did admire one another very much. So that is true. Harry is right to remind us he had a real grasp of human anatomy and of animal anatomy. One of the great debates in science in the 18th century was between what we would call biblical fundamentalists, who thought that the Almighty had made human beings essentially different from the rest of the animal kingdom. And one of the signs that we were different was that we didn't have this strange little bone called, I think the Germans call it the intermaxillary bone, which is down here. It's part of the biting device on the. And Goethe said this was rubbish and that we do have it, but that what happens is that it's to be seen in the fetus. Of course, this is ages before the invention of X-ray, but that it, by the time the baby's born, we don't really need it, so it's sort of under. That's turned out to be completely true. And there were other German anatomists at the time who poo-pooed him and then realised what he said was absolutely true. To my mind, the anatomical discovery that he made, which is almost eerie that it's so brilliant, he was walking along the beach the first time he ever went to Venice. He'd never seen the sea before. And there was a sheep's skull on the Lido. And he picked it up out of the sand, and he looked at it, and it was a full sheep's skull with bits of the old vertebrae and the backbone coming into it. By the time he'd finished his walk, Goethe had realised really the future of neuroscience, the stuff that they are now still puzzling about, namely how do the signals get sent to the brain by our nervous systems. And it all, Goethe was the very first anatomist to realise it all came up through the spinal cords. And all the signals moving into our brains, as we speak, telling you to move your hands, telling you to speak or shut up, in my case, whatever it may be, they all come. It's the most extraordinary thing that all these bits inside our head, strands and lumps of stuff that look like jelly and stuff on the butcher's slab, are capable of producing consciousness and awareness, and as I say, through the nerve endings, these signals of movement, and interfere with them in one shape or form. Whether you have a stroke or somebody interferes with you through careless surgery, and the whole system goes kaput, as we know. Goethe was the first person fully to understand all that. And if you talk to neuroscientists, they all say he began this science. I mean, many people would think that was an achievement enough on its own, even if you hadn't become a great poet, even if you hadn't been a great political force, and so on. And also, what I think I ought to say about Faust, and indeed the... I don't want to go on about Goethe all evening, don't worry. Is that he had it right about the mysteriousness of human life. And that's why there are so many branches of knowledge, including, we could be here all night, psychoanalysis, modern religious thought, philosophy and so on, which are contained in his work. And in his conversations, which, if you haven't read, they're wonderful, the recorded conversations.
And there's an argument saying he predicted the rise of America as a superpower, and even predicted, long before he was born, the rise of Adolf Hitler.
Well, I'm not sure about the Adolf Hitler bit, but certainly, let's concentrate on America. This is the sort of way that a truly brilliant mind works, if you think of the sheep skull idea that I was just telling you about. There was a German explorer and scientist called Alexander von Humboldt, who went to explore in South America, Central America, and sent back accounts of it all. And Goethe was one day, when he was an old man, reading von Humboldt's account of Panama. Again, a place I've mentioned, the golf courses of Scotland, but Panama is also of interest to our friend, the president. But Goethe said, if you built a canal, this is 50 years before anybody built the Panama Canal, if you built a canal through the isthmus, that's how you say it, in Panama, America would become a superpower, because it would control both oceans. I mean, this was when America was really quite a primitive country. It hadn't conquered the West. Most of the landmass of what's now the United States was uninhabited. But he could see it. He could see the potential of it. That's the kind of extraordinariness you get. Of course, you mentioned Hitler. Everybody does if you have Germany in the same sentence. It's going to end up with Hitler, even if you're not Basil Fawlty or whatever. And in a way, Faust is a prediction of what's going to happen, because, it, among other things, it's about the abuse of power and the abuse of intellect, which is what happened during the National Socialist era. The thing which is in rather small print, if you go round the Goethe house in Weimar, and you think, this is rather a nice house, I wonder how they managed to preserve it. Because during the 19th century, Goethe's only surviving child died of booze. The daughter-in-law ran out of money, and her two sons couldn't afford to keep up the house, so one of them died there. And so it was more or less a wreck by the time they left it, through death. And by the beginning of the 20th century, the Goethe house was in very poor nick, and most of his collection, he collected all sorts of works of art and Italian medallions and classical sculpture and all sorts of things, had been dispersed, and his library had been dispersed. And when the Bauhaus movement began and the Weimar Republic began, all those people despised Goethe's classical taste, and they thought he was horribly old-fashioned and boring, and they thought the house was rather ugly, so they didn't spend any money on it at all. And it was only, I'm afraid to tell you, in 1933 that the house had a wonderful makeover from a generous donor one Mr. A. Hitler, who devoted a huge amount of the royalties of Mein Kampf to restoring the Goethehaus and going around and finding his lost collections and trying to reproduce what it would have looked like when he lived there. So that it, there is that rather strange connection.
Amazing, yeah. And you're very good in your book about the character of Goethe. Turn of, say, a healthy ego, like many writers, keen on the booze, like his son, and grew enormously fat. Is that right?
He really did become fat after a certain period, and his wife also became fat. And it is said one gin and tonic is the equivalent of two cream buns. I'm not a great dietitian, but I think there is. I think if you drink a lot, you can be in danger of putting on weight. His mysteriously came down again, but he was a prodigious drinker, an absolute prodigious drinker. And sometimes, because I've told you about Faust, he wrote 40 plays, and he did run, and as well as running everything else, he ran the local theatre. If students came and found his plays boring, which it must be admitted most of them are, and booed or laughed, and by that stage of the proceedings in the evening, he would have been absolutely plastered, because he had a bottle of wine for breakfast, he had lots of wine at lunch, and then when he was in the theatre, he had a great big bowl of punch, which was empty by the time the evening was over. And if somebody laughed, which wasn't meant to be funny, he would get up and thunder at them, because it was not meant to be funny. And of course, he was in that sense a kind of classical, stereotypical German, thinking that laughter was an offence rather than a natural response to life. And because he did control everything, including the army and the police, if you laughed in the wrong place in Goethe's theatre, there were many cases of people being actually arrested in the I think he would have been rather like, remember, there's a good joke by Bertrand Russell in his History of Western Philosophy. What was the German idea of freedom? Well, Hegel's idea of freedom was freedom to obey the police. Goethe would have agreed with that, I think.
And we're here also to talk about your biography of Queen Victoria, a life that you are, among your many books, you are a great expert on not just Queen Victoria, but the Victorians. You wrote a book called The Victorians and After the Victorians, a biography of Queen Victoria and a biography of Prince Albert, the man who saved the monarchy.
Yes.
The suggestion that Queen Victoria had a secret child with John Brown. Do you laugh this out of court?
I don't. If I was less lazy, I would actually withdraw my Queen Victoria book and rewrite quite a lot of it. But a strange thing has been happening to me recently, actually, that I've been obsessed by the 19th century since I was a little boy. And I think it's partly because I grew up with pretty elderly parents, and my father was the baby of his family. His sisters were Victorians, so I mean, I knew what it was like to converse with people that should remember the Boer War and things like that. And I think I was in love with the 19th century, and I'm now out of love with it, but still obsessed by it. I just think so many awful things did happen. And equally, I wrote a book for Prince Albert, The Men Who Saved the Monarchy. I thought he was marvellous while I was writing the book. I now rather revise my view of the poor Prince Consort, I must admit. And I think being married to him must have been absolute hell. And I feel sorrier than I used to for Queen Victoria, who in her way was... she was a very tiresome person in many ways, but there was something very lovable about her. And she was craving all the things which Prince Albert never gave her, really. Credit for being an independent human being, for one thing. He was a control freak. And when he died, age 42, poor chap, and poor her, she turned for comfort to his favourite Highland gilly, John Brown. I had always been persuaded, when I was doing my research for those books, by the testimony of Queen Victoria's doctor, who was a man called James Reed, who was the grandfather of one of your sainted predecessors as editor of the Old
Richard Ingram.
Richard Ingram is the grandson of Dr. Reed. Dr. Reed, and this is a rather indelicate remark, so I apologise to everybody present, but Dr. Reed did an examination of Queen Victoria after she died, and she suffered from a prolapsed uterus and must have been in extraordinary discomfort, but she never allowed the doctor to, so much as to touch her little, you know, he wasn't allowed to take her pulse or anything of that kind. Most of the diagnosis had to be done by little bits of paper. She wrote him a note every day to tell him about her laboratory activities and so on. I've seen them all in Dr. Reed's house. It's an amazing thing in Scotland. And he believed that because of this condition that poor woman was suffering from, which, I mean, just the one further indelicacy, I don't want to have an indelicate evening. If she'd only told him, the doctor just has to do that, basically, and you're back to normal. the doctor believed that she had a most improper relationship with John Brown, and there's a lot about it in his diary. And remember what I just said, the doctor wasn't even allowed to take her pulse. She would come in, giggling her head off, in the arms of John Brown. John Brown used to carry her in and out of the room and up and down the stairs and things in her various houses. So there clearly was some kind of intimacy which was deemed improper by the doctor. But the doctor thought that a full marriage or a full union wouldn't have been possible. Well, there's something very, very illogical about that, because we don't know, because he only examined her when she was dead, we don't know when this unfortunate condition occurred. It could well not. It could have happened after she'd known Brown, and after Brown died. So I've come round to this story, which I've read about. I haven't seen the documentary, I don't think I've seen it on the telly. There's a lady in America who does, I must say, look rather like Queen Victoria, who believes herself to be the descendant of John Brown and Queen Victoria. And I think it's perfectly possible.
Fits with the timing during the Widow of Windsor years.
It fits completely the timing. The fact that she had these long periods when the politicians were in despair because she refused to come out. She was never seen in public anywhere. It fits with that. It fits with the fact, probably there are many of you who are aware of the Iona community in Scotland, which was founded by a rather marvellous clergyman called George MacLeod. And George MacLeod's father, Norman MacLeod, was also a Presbyterian minister who said to George MacLeod, I emphasise the Iona community type element. We're not here with gutter journalists like me who want a good story. We're with people of high probity and honesty. Norman MacLeod said to his son on his deathbed, the one thing I really regret in my life as a Presbyterian minister was marrying the Queen to John Brown of Crathay. He was a parish minister at Cathay Parish Church. So I haven't the smallest doubt that a marriage ceremony took place.
Sometime before the birth of this putative church.
That I don't know. I don't know when the marriage took place. But on the royal train, the ladies had one carriage, and Brown and the Queen had another carriage, and they slept and went up on the sleeper. So, I mean, I think there's every suggestion that it was a full union. And the other thing which makes me think that this story is true is that Her Late Majesty, great woman of our times, of course, and I revere the Queen and Princess Margaret ditto, they were so touchy about this subject, and they were so furious with anyone who made any suggestion that there was a love, let alone marriage, between Queen Victoria and John Brown. It makes me realise that they knew it was true.
Because is it the case, I remember talking to another royal biographer who said until recently, if you wanted to get something out of the Royal Library at Windsor, you couldn't say, can I have the letters from so-and-so to so-and-so. It'd be like a sort of lucky dip, and they'd give you something they wanted to give you.
That was absolutely true. And they were incredibly kind to me at the Royal Archive, and it's been put up on a really modern footing. Now it's a proper archive. And a fellow called Sir Christopher Guyte, who became Lord Guyte and then became a cropper because Boris Johnson had him as the man who was looking after public morals, which was a rather a difficult thing to be doing during the Prime Ministership. Anyway, he lucky chap, was able to discard that particular role. But when he became the Queen's private secretary, and he was an excellent private secretary who organised, for instance, her visit to Ireland, which did a tremendous amount of good to both Ireland and England, Ireland and the rest of Britain, he sacked the archivists who used to play this sort of game, and he put in professional archivists, professional librarians, and so on. But yes, when I first went there, that archivist you're alluding to was quite absurd. She shouldn't ever have been allowed the job. For a start, she didn't know one word of the German language. Well, I mean, the Prince Albert wrote in German. The huge Albert archive is all in German. Half Queen Victoria's stuff is letters from different parts of her family in different parts of Europe, all of whom wrote in German to her. So it's ridiculous. But it's absolutely true. You couldn't say, I want to go into the matter of how Queen Victoria responded to, let's say, the outbreak of the Crimean War, which would be the normal thing to do in the library. You couldn't even say, can I see stuff from the 1850s? You just had to be... were you lucky enough to be given a letter that Pam, such was her name, considered you could be trusted to read? And therefore, she only gave you the most boring anodyne things, which you knew already because they'd been in print.
Amazing. And if you'd met Queen Victoria, would you have liked her? She's very clever, wasn't she? Good writer?
She was a marvellous writer. I think even though her awful daughter rewrote some of the journals and cut out some of the better bits, I think.
Which daughter was that?
Beatrice, the baby. She called her baby. So the bits that survive are wonderful. And the letters she wrote, which Princess Beatrice couldn't get her hands on, the letters she wrote to her firstborn, Vicky, who became the German Empress, are superb. I think they're among the great letters of literature. And she was a real writer. Had she not been the Queen of England, she could easily, in my view, have been a great writer. And I think she had true perception of things. She was very observant. She was also a rather good painter. If I'm allowed to say so without disloyalty or lèse majesté, a bloody sight better painter than our present monarch. She had a real colour sense and a sense of form. She was taught by Lansky. Of course, if you got on the wrong side of her, she could be very tiresome and was halfway to being nuts. I mean, her grandfather was a loony, and she had these rages which were beyond normal anger.
And Prince Albert, you said you slightly changed your opinion on him, but he also remarkably intelligent, very energetic.
Well, he really was a very, very clever person, and there's no doubt about that. And I've been writing this year about the Great Exhibition, the organising of the Great Exhibition, and his embrace of free trade, whatever you think about free trade, and his understanding of how the arrival of free trade and the changing of the class system and the rise of the middle class and of capitalism and of what we would call sort of new conservatism utterly changed the whole of European history, because the British owed their power to all this stuff. He grasped that, and there was something extraordinary about him. And his obsession with taste and clothes and jewels and colours and all that stuff, they're semi-comic, of course they are, but there is something very remarkable about him. And he was quite a good musician. His brother was a very, very good composer. His brother composed 5 operas.
What was he called?
Ernest.
And Andrew, you write extensively in the papers. In fact, today you've written in Daily Mail a brilliant piece about Prince William. How strong do you think the monarchy is today?
Well, I don't know what anyone else here thinks, but I think it's in rather a bad way.
Because in what way?
The statistics are that 60% of people between the ages of 16 and 30. It's quite a large poll, I think it's a reliable poll. 60% want a republic. And only 50% of the older group now do. I mean, when the similar poll was taken on the day the Queen died or the week after she died, everybody said they were monarchists. But in the cool light of day, when you see things such as that television programme, which was in conjunction with the Sunday Times expose of the Duchy of Cornwall, you know, Prince William is getting £23 million a year from the Duchy of Cornwall. He wouldn't be doing, he wouldn't get any money at all from the Duchy of Cornwall if he wasn't, by luck, the Prince of Wales. So it's in a sense public money. It's not their private money. It shouldn't be. And Queen Victoria was constantly quarrelling with her ministers, both the income from the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall. It should be put into the public purse. It shouldn't be theirs. They've got dozens of palaces. They're extremely rich by any standards. And all this will, you know, you only have to have a few scandals, a few Prince Andrews, and the 60% among the 16 to 30-year-olds, and they're, after all, the future, will turn to 75%, 80%.
And you wrote an extremely good piece in the Oldie, a review of the Andrew Loney biography of Prince Andrew. Do you think in the history of royal baddies, he's high up there, or they've always been duds?
Prince Andrew reminds me of some of the really awful uncles of Queen Victoria. I mentioned Duke Ernst, who was the good composer of Saxe Coburg, but Ernest, Duke of Cumberland, who would have been King of England if Queen Victoria hadn't been born, and who became the King of Hanover, was an absolute thug. He murdered his butler. He's thought to have had a love affair with one of his sisters. And he was a grossly scandalous figure. And the other uncles are pretty awful, actually. Nice little Duke of Sussex, I rather like him. But no, I think Prince Andrew, we've only had snippets so far of what he got up to. And it leaves a very nasty taste in the mouth, that book by Andrew Loney. I mean, I couldn't have written it, but it's the sheer patience of going through the extravagance and the greed of that couple.
It's gripping. We've got time for some questions. I think there's a roving mic, isn't there, Lindsay? So if anyone's got any questions, if you could wait for the mic. A gentleman in the front row here.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to just preface my remark or my question with an appreciation of yourself and your organisation and your very wise magazine, to which I subscribe for years.
Thank you so much, and I promise you the cheque is in the post.
Yeah. Especially as an old journal.
Yeah.
Leave that aside. What I'd like to observe in addition to that compliment, if I don't put it like that, is that the magazine can do something for many of us older people who run establishments in Dartmouth, for example, but in many holiday places. We get many, many visitors, some more welcome than others, but a lot of us feel like hoteliers in the middle of the summer.
Yeah.
And the fact is, of course, that the Oldie, unlike any other magazine, is, or seems to be, bedside reading of choice amongst visitors who are looking for, I think, the mixture which you have managed to strike very expertly of factual, unprejudiced, but relatively long-lived coverage of issues. So, unlike my pile of private eyes, which don't get the attention of our visitors, because they are here today and gone tomorrow, to use another.
So you're fantastic. I think you might put your quote on the cover of the next issue.
Very welcome. The present one from Fry is perfectly adequate, I think.
Fantastic. Yes, Fry's. Yeah. Thank you so much, sir.
I do have a question.
Yes, great. Yeah.
And that, it's a little bit difficult to word it accurately in ignorance, of course, but one of the things that I think has interested me about our speaker has been that the association has moved, and I'll just put it in crude political terms, to the right. And maybe in your early days, when I think I'm right in saying you're concentrating on your fiction.
Yes.
You had a more radical view, dare I use that word, but you certainly...
Is that fair enough? Would you say you've moved to the right hand?
Insofar as I'm aware of my opinions, I think I've moved much far to the left, I would suggest. I don't have very much sympathy with any of the forces of reaction.
Yes. That, as a young man, you were held up, rightly or wrongly, as one of the leading young fogies.
I was a fuddy-duddy fogey, certainly. I'm still a fuddy-duddy fogey when it comes to sort of conventional things like wearing clothes and that sort of thing. But I don't see where you derive that from anything I've said or written. But
sorry, so we must have some more questions.
Telegraph and for the
The
mail.
But if you're hanging around the lamppost wanting a client to come past, you don't necessarily ask their opinion. and that's what a hack is. I write for
sort of cab rank principle. Yes.
Thank you for a very interesting and entertaining session. But I'm interested to know that you are such a prolific writer. How did you choose your topic? What are you writing about next? Or does it choose you?
Well, I mean, obviously, if I was left to myself, and if I had a huge private income, I would probably be able to sit at home and write haiku or something like that. But as it is, if somebody does come along to me, for instance, I said to you I was just writing about the Great Exhibition. The committee that organised the Great Exhibition in 1851 is still in existence. It's refreshed itself. It's not still the same people. And they've asked me to write their history and the history of the effects of the Great Exhibition and how all the profits were spent on building the Royal Albert Hall and the Imperial College and the Natural History Museum, etc., etc. So that's what I've been doing for the last 18 months. And other things, I think to myself, well, I'd rather like to write a novel about that or whatever it might be.
Any more questions? Yes, gentlemen.
Good evening. The closeness of Germany and England through the Victorian period came to pieces very, very badly.
Yes.
In the 20th century. I wonder how you account for that.
Well, I mean, one small element of it, but it turned out to be a much bigger element than you'd have guessed if you just compared royal history in the past, was that it was a family row that Edward VII detested the German emperor, the person we now always call the Kaiser for some reason. And the Kaiser was a horrible person, and I think Edward VII was a horrible person too. So that was one element. And the arms race, which grew up from about the 1880s or 90s onwards until 1914, is tragic. And it's a very good example, I think, of the idea that building up huge supplies of arms will always provide a deterrent against war, which people always say about nuclear weapons, and so far that's semi-true, isn't it, of nuclear weapons? But it isn't true necessarily of building up arms, which is why I'm so terrified by people saying the only way to stop Putin is to build up more and more arms. Because if you build up arms, eventually somebody's going to want to use them, and that is what happened. There was a kind of growing rivalry, trade rivalry, political rivalry between these two European superpowers, Britain and Germany. But I don't believe anybody in 1913, however anti-German they might have been in England, however anti-British they might have been in Germany, could have predicted the horror that was going to be unleashed by really a series of diplomatic accidents that Britain had locked itself in, partly thanks to the Entente Cordiale of Edward VII, with France's obligations to defend, as it happens, to defend the Russians. And it's utter tragedy, isn't it, the outbreak of the First World War. And after that, my father, as I say, was quite an old man when I was born, so he did remember the German baker near where they lived in North Staffordshire, having all the windows smashed on the outbreak. I mean, it's a place where they'd gone to buy all their cream cakes and things. There was no political element to it at all. It's rather like the Italian delicatessens of being smashed up in Soho at the beginning of the Second World War. And people genuinely thinking it was unpatriotic to play a Beethoven piano sonata. They were worse in the First World War in that way than they had been in the Second World War, where Myra Hess and people were keeping an idea of German culture going. And because of all that, a whole couple of generations came into existence who thought it was unpatriotic to know or read German culture. It's an utter and complete tragedy. There's a lady at the back there.
So, I was wondering, you mentioned that you'd kind of like to take back your book on Victoria and rewrite it, and you also said that you've changed your mind about Albert being the saviour of the monarchy, or slightly changed your mind.
Well, I think he saved the monarchy, but I'm not sure whether anything that's a particularly good thing to have done, I'm sorry.
Okay, so I was just wondering, do you have these second thoughts about all your books, or is it just a few? Are there some that you think that is the best book I could possibly have written? I'd never take it back or change it.
This is a deep waters, Watson, but I do have second thoughts about almost everything, to tell you the truth. I'm a wishy-washy, dithery person, and I no longer have an opinion, and if somebody says, I've read your article on so-and-so, by the time the article on so-and-so is in print, I've probably decided I actually think the complete opposite. So, but in the case of Prince Albert, having only seen what an effective operator he was and how much I admired all that and his intelligence, I now think many of the things he stood for were pretty disastrous, including all the things I just named, free trade, etc. And I think his beastliness to Queen Victoria is awful. And I just find him a very, very charmless, humourless, stiff person, whereas I was sort of overlooking all those things. I was so anxious to think the best of him. Don't know why.
And there's a lady here in the second row. Yeah. Yep.
I shout.
Oh, just on its way down.
Probably might be.
No, 2 seconds
shouting
away.
Is all right.
Shouting's all right.
It was a really insightful and interesting talk. Mesmerising, actually, and I just wondered, given that there is a plethora of books on subjects like Queen Victoria,
yes,
how do you go about finding that distinctive take that where there are so many other authors who are in that pond, or is it more about a distinctive voice?
Well, I can't completely answer the second bit about the voice, because I'm not entirely in control of it, I don't think, but what I've always tried to do with these biographies I've written, I've always been in the fortunate position of being able to go back to primary sources. And in the case of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, I mean, at Windsor, the nice new archivist dumped a file on my desk, and I'd been going there for about 3 years to do Prince Albert, and said, when you finish that, you've read the whole blooming lot. And I think it's quite a good idea only to concentrate on the primary sources, and then after that read what other people have had to say. And I mean, you mentioned John Betjeman and C.S. Lewis at the beginning, Harry, and I was lucky with both those, that insofar as there is a Lewis archive in America, I read my way through that. And with Betjeman, because I knew his family, I just went to their house and read everything, really. So, and then I think a take does emerge. It's a bit like you form an immediate impression, which is then, through experience, turned into what your settled impression is. And that's what happens when you're doing research.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, but thank you all so much for coming here tonight, and thanks so much to the brilliant A.N. Wilson.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.